This afternoon, I have the honor of introducing our keynote speaker, Tony Geraci. Where to begin? Tony is from New Orleans, and anyone who's been to New Orleans knows that as serious as that city is about their music, they're just as serious about their food, and that's your first cue. Tony, a restaurateur turned businessman, has worked throughout the country with food service directors, school lunch programs, and corporations to streamline operations and incorporate local foods and nutrition into their plans. Tony has used his wisdom, his savvy, his passion, and his energy to bring local foods to the table in our country. Tony was the developer and executive director of First Cause. This is a culinary training and job placement program for developmentally disabled people and those recovering from substance abuse and mental illness. Since 2008, Tony has been in my hometown of Baltimore, saving the day one school meal at a time. He served as the director of food nutrition for the Baltimore City Public School System, and he successfully transformed that program into a more efficient operation that sources all of its produce from Maryland farms. And you can imagine the revenue that creates for those Maryland farms and the money it saves Baltimore. Also, while in Baltimore, Tony founded Great Kids Farm, a 33-acre farm used for vocational training and food production for the Baltimore area. Tony has received numerous accolades. He's been featured in several periodicals, and recently the feature of Cafeteria Man, a documentary regarding his work with the Baltimore City Public School System. It's an honor to have him here this afternoon. Before he comes out and speaks, I'm going to play the trailer to that movie, Cafeteria Man.
Rock, baby. Tony Geraci is with us. He's Baltimore's new director of food and nutrition.
Here in Baltimore, I'm currently in the process of building a central kitchen for the school systems.
We got 85,000 kids out there that's looking for a meal every day. His responsibility is to make sure that he gives them these fresh fruits and vegetables that we're asking for.
This has never been done. We're making some history right here. This is going to be a model that every state in this country is going to start using to feed their kids local fresh food. My boss, Dr. Alonzo, wants this to happen, and that's why I was hired. I was hired to make that happen.
Focusing on school food reform is at some level essential.
We wanted to have our lunch better because it was disgusting.
It's always pizza.
Pizza, pizza, pizza.
Yeah, it is always pizza.
The milk was sour. The bread was molded.
NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. What have you done?
Urban agriculture projects. Increase awareness to our kids, only Maryland-grown fruits and vegetables to be purchased by our school district.
So I can buy Maryland peaches for 8 cents a piece, right, or I can buy USDA peaches packed in a can at 14 cents a portion. It's ludicrous.
I ate because I was hungry and I had nothing to eat, and I didn't bring lunch every day, so that was the only food I had.
Kids always want to tell me what's wrong.
We brought the food down and gave it to the school board.
We want you to try it.
It's not reasonable, and that's what we told them.
The number one thing they talk about is cafeteria food.
We have a 33-acre organic farm.
Like, I see things finished. This little thing right here is going to be a farm stand. Down here in the big animal barn, you know, I want to put chickens, turkeys, and geese. And I saw kids planting things and taking things back to their schools. This place needs to be a living, breathing, working farm where kids see the animals and they see that whole process. And they get that, you know, food doesn't come from a bag at Safeway.
If Baltimore can pull this off, it will send a signal that this is an investment worth making.
Hey,
You guys are revolutionaries in the truest sense of the word.
It feels good.
I think it's really important that Tony's in the position that he's in. I think if somebody's unleashing the type of vision he's unleashing, I could not do his job.
They all need to be loading at the same time.
You start like a 4 a.m. shift.
I don't think I had the courage to do Tony's job.
The resources in Maryland are amazing. The farms in Maryland are amazing.
If Tony makes this happen here the way he has promised to, the way he wants to, and it works, I think you'll see this happening all over the country.
The schools are like an $800 million a year economic driver. Why the hell aren't we spending the money here? How do we do this? How do we figure this stuff out?
What I'm proposing is a completely different paradigm.
This is crazy. We need a recipe for change.
Is this film going to make me look fat?
Good afternoon, Pennsylvania! This has been a really insightful and important conference, and I'm glad to be part of it. My name is Tony Geraci. I was born and raised in New Orleans, grew up above a nightclub on Bourbon Street.
But I was fortunate to be able to grow up in a city that names its highways after chefs. So for me, it's always been about the food. I learned how to cook from my two grandmothers. My father's mother is from Italy, and my mother's mother is the Française de Louisiane, right? So it was an amazing childhood. I grew up in a family of chefs. I grew up in a restaurant family. I've been a very successful restaurateur, and I learned a lot about business by connecting with my clients. And I used that same strategy when I got into child nutrition to reconnect with the client, and the client are the kids. In Baltimore, I worked for 86,000 children. Right? That was my boss, right? So Baltimore, as many of you know, is a city in transition, right? It's like many sort of Rust Belt cities across America, it has to redefine itself because the old sort of paradigm of their economic model has changed, right? And what has happened often in cities is the children get lost in the shuffle, right? And we need to kind of reconnect that because, you know, as hokey and cliche as it sounds, it is our future that we're talking about now, you know? One in three children born after the year 2000 are going to get type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. One in two African-American or children of color will get this disease in their lifetime. That's a travesty, and it's a reality. I grew up in a generation where polio just about decimated this planet, children. But we as a planet decided that we would do something about it, that we would eradicate this thing, that we would attack it viciously, ferociously, and by and large, we've eradicated that disease. Type 2 diabetes is a very reversible disease, and it's something that can change quickly. My first job as a food service director in a small district in southern New Hampshire, in the first week that I was there, I got called into the nurse's office, right, to talk with this kid, this 11-year-old boy, who was in the nurse's office because... his fingers were too sore to grip a pencil anymore from checking his blood, right? And this little boy sat there in this chair, and his belly was black and blue from multiple injection sites, and his legs were black and blue from multiple injection sites.
And this kid was crying in this chair because he didn't understand what was going on with his body. He was a good kid. He did what his parents asked him to do. He was a good student. You know, his mom and dad worked hard. And, you know, they drove to school and dropped him off. And, you know, he'd eat a half a dozen donuts on the way to school because that's what they did, right? You know, they had pizza night because there wasn't time to go home and cook. They had, you know, dinner with the colonel because they didn't have time to go home and cook. When he got good test scores, they went to McBurger World and they got a Happy Meal. Because that was the reward. That was what his parents believed was a good thing. And now this kid is 11 years old, crying about a disease that was destroying his life. Well, it was very personal for me in that a year before, I had an accident and broke my back in several places and had a lot of internal damage and a lot of bad things, and a lot of people, I rushed to my comfort zone, and my comfort zone was food, right? And I ate everything in sight, and I gained about 100 pounds. And in the process, I became an insulin-dependent type 2 diabetic, and I was injecting myself 4 or 5 times a day to control this disease, and that was kind of the tipping point for me. And I knew that given this responsibility as the new food service director, that maybe I had to start doing something about that. I'm happy to say that November the 13th of this year will be 5 years. I am insulin and drug free. So it is reversible. It's changeable. But you have to have the will to make that happen. So I was offered this position in Baltimore City Public Schools to be their new food service director. Let me find my little clicker here. I was offered the job by this guy right here, Dr. Antonio Andres Alonso. He is from Cuba, and he's an amazing guy. And he also believes that it was unrealistic to have an expectation that his teachers were going to be able to deliver a lesson plan to his students that were hungry or jacked up on sugar. And he understood completely the notion that child nutrition is something beyond putting food on the tray, right? That it is readiness, you know? And we had this meeting, and, you know, I was kind of called in. I laid out a business plan and said how I was going to do everything, and I'm in a room full of these suits, right? And they're all like, well, it's never going to work, you know, it's too hard. The bureaucracy will stop. It will, you know, it just won't happen. And I heard Alonzo mumble under his breath, then I will kill the bureaucracy, right? And meeting ends, I fly home, right? And then Christmas Eve, I get this little cryptic email, right? With a link to the Baltimore Sun. And I open the link, and it says, Dr. Alonzo fires 236 bureaucrats at central office. And there's a little note at the bottom that says, do you still want the job? Hell yes, right? So I came to Baltimore. And I came to Baltimore with a clear message from my boss. Make this happen, right? So Baltimore is a poor city. 88.6% of the kids qualify for free meals. But this is how child nutrition works in K-12, right? If you don't serve the meal, you don't get the federal reimbursement to pay for the meals, to pay for the labor, to pay for everything else. So the bottom line is, if the kid doesn't eat, you don't get paid. Real simple formula, right? So in a city that 86,000 kids qualify for free meals, for breakfast, they were serving 8,500 meals a day. And why? Because it was crap, all right? And it was inconvenient. And it was all of the things that didn't make sense. So I'm a chef. I went to my pantry. I opened the doors of my pantry, and I looked inside, and I said, what do I have? I have birds. I have ravens and Orioles, right? So I went to the Baltimore Ravens, and I went to the Baltimore Orioles, and I said, help me. Help me feed these kids.
And I understood that there's this direct connection between nutrition and performance. Whether it's, you know, academic performance or physical performance, it's the same. We are machines. We require fuel. So I invented these little breakfast boxes, right? So inside of these little boxes, there's, you know, the lowest sugar cereal on the market, 100% juice, a whole grain snack that didn't have preservatives or dyes, and a carton of milk. And they were portable, and they were shelf-stable, and I could inventory them, and I could move them around. And I set up breakfast in the classroom. Breakfast in the classroom, I believe, is the most efficient delivery method for getting kids fed and for ensuring that they're ready for the lesson plan for the day. And it becomes a teaching moment, right? And Baltimore is also sort of a union city, right? And the lunch lady said, it's not in our contract. We can't do that. So I said, you're right. You're right. So I got the kids. I took the oldest group of kids in each school, and I said, because, you know, I grew up in New Orleans, and I went to all of the best Jesuit schools there. In fact, I was thrown out of all of the best Jesuit schools. But I secretly lusted after the hall monitor sash, right? Because it was an outward sign of respect and nobility, something I did not have, right? So I made the oldest group of kids in the school the breakfast monitors as part of my breakfast club, right? And we did this thing called Breakfast in Birdland, right? And the kids would bring the breakfast into the classroom, pick up the trash at the end of it, and we gave them community service hour credit for the work that they did, right? They're supposed to be doing so much community service to even graduate, right? It's like, how do we expect kids to be good citizens if we don't give them citizenship skills, right? So also, the school that had the best breakfast participation for the month got to have breakfast with the Ravens and the Orioles, their mascots, their trainers, their dietitians, you know, and they talked about how this worked. They talked about the importance of this thing. And it was very purposeful that I did it this way because I wanted my kids to understand that there was a different role model. That rather than the dude rolling through the neighborhood in a Lexus with a trunk full of cocaine, that story ends the same way. Every city, every time, no deviation, right? But a kid that had an opportunity to have education unlocked and a pathway to college, that maybe they could change their circumstance, that maybe their lives could be impacted in a more positive way. Hey, look, I began my life in the Desire Street Projects in New Orleans. That's where I was born. I didn't live there a long time, but my family began there, and we worked hard to get out of there. So, look, I'm a first-generation American, and I believe in the power of this country. I believe in the opportunity that's here, and I think that we should try to remember that sometimes as we roll ahead. The other thing is, you know, on the back of the Ravens box, they had all of their rookies and all of their players on the back here in their college jerseys, and the tagline is, the best play we ever made, staying in school, getting an education, changing their lives, you know? Inside of these boxes, I also had the secret code, right? One in 20 of these boxes won something. You know, an MP3 player, a DVD, Ravens hats, jerseys, you know, whatever swag I could hustle, right? And again, it was very purposeful, you know, and kind of very Pavlovian. The kids were tearing open the boxes looking for the prizes, but eventually they started eating the contents of the boxes, and we went from serving 8,500 breakfasts a day to 45,000 breakfasts a day in 60 days, right? The economic impact of that was an additional $22 million into this program. Now I have money. Now I've got the means to do the changes that I need to do and get it done. So that was sort of the step one. Look, if you walk the streets of Baltimore and you look at the ground and you look at the trash on the ground, that's what kids eat because that's what they know, because that's what they have access to, right? They live in a giant food desert there, all right? So you can't have this expectation that these kids are going to be eating organic food, from Whole Foods if that's not in their world, right? So you have to sort of begin someplace. And we began with this, right? And we were able to expand it later. So the other thing I wanted to do was reconnect kids with real food, right? So how do you do that? If you don't have reference points, you have to recreate those reference points. We've successfully raised an entire generation of children that think fruit is a flavor. It is a fruity flavor. There's no association to food, right? So you have to change that. So I think that if you give a kid a seed and you let a kid plant that seed and you watch that seed grow and turn into a plant and bear fruit that then they can harvest, that then they can prepare, that they can then share with their peers, it forever changes the way they look at food. It is no longer consumption. It's a different thing. There's a different lesson being taught. There's a different story being told. So there's this abandoned piece of land in Baltimore, 33 acres. It was founded by that gentleman sitting there in the middle. His name was Reverend George Bragg. He was born a slave. And he got that the Emancipation Proclamation had been proclaimed. But he knew that his people would never experience freedom, real freedom, until they had economic freedom. And in order to do that, you had to create jobs and skills and training. This is a largely agro community that we live in. So he wanted his kids to be able to learn how to become carpenters and plumbers and electricians and machinists and people that could work on the farm equipment so that they had jobs, right? So that they had upward mobility, so that they could create a black middle class in this country that up until a few years before did not exist, right? The guy was a visionary. So that's it. You see that little patch of green down there? That's the Great Kids Farm. It is in the heart of Babylon, right? It is surrounded by strip malls, pizza shops, muffler shops, anything but a farm. It's out on Route 40, 6601 Baltimore Pike, right? So if you ever by, swing by and see Greg Strella, who's the farm manager there. And so we thought that we would use this farm to teach, right? And teaching with taste. Look, as you can probably figure by now, I'm not that smart, right? And I was a horrible student, right? Look, I didn't get math until I started taking apart recipes, doing the conversions, right? I didn't understand chemistry until I saw bread rise. That was the voice for me. That was the thing that unlocked education for me. And I'm convinced that, you know, a lot of kids think this way and learn this way, and they don't learn in a traditional way. So let's stop trying to force a test down their throats, and let's start teaching them critical thought process, and let's start unlocking things for them so they can learn. So that kid right there is tasting a radish green for the very first time in his life. So we learn with our eyes, we learn with our ears, we see, we hear, but we also smell and we taste. You know, we taste. You know, it's pretty amazing when you taste something for the first time that what it's like, what? You know? And you want to try something else. This process also unlocks the door to education and higher education, right? So we want our kids to understand that there's something beyond the hood. That there's something beyond these impoverished streets and neighborhoods that they live in, that there's college. So I created this curriculum around agro-hospitality, right? It's a good made-up word I made up. It's a good one. It just means from the farm to the fork, right? So in all of the jobs that are associated in agro-hospitality, right? So it's not just being a farmer. It's not just being a cook. You know, there's math and science and language and art and music, you know, logistics and technology and all kinds of things that will unlock a door and a pathway for a child to learn and succeed. So this forum was really critical to sort of do that.
So we actually grow microgreens there. That was our first cash crop, right? And I'm a chef. So a lot of my chef friends, I got on the phone and I said, look, man, let me start doing custom stuff for you, you know? And there was one chef in particular, Spike Gertie, who owns Woodbury Kitchen in Baltimore. It was named one of the top five American restaurants. And just amazing stuff. He's an amazing chef. And he believed in this thing. And he said, okay, Tony, you know, whatever you can grow, I'm going to buy. I'm just going to sort of get out there and just, I'll figure it out. We'll figure out this thing together. And so we started doing custom microgreen blends, right? And then another restaurateur said, who had dinner at Spike, said, hey, could you do that for me? And then another guy said, hey, can you do that for me? And then pretty soon, I've got an army of chefs and restaurants that are getting it, that understand it. Look, being a chef and working in this industry, coming up back of the house, you know, it's like they're full of, you know, misfits and vagabonds, right? You know, this is, you know, when I became a chef, people thought, well, he's a chef because he's a slacker and, you know, this is probably the only thing he can do. You know, the reality is, me becoming a chef allowed me to travel all over this planet. I have cooked from Hartford to Hong Kong in this trade. And I've been extremely successful in this trade. And it is the last industry on the planet that you can go from the stockroom to the boardroom in without a lot of education. It's more about tenacity and will and talent, you know, and your willingness to hone your craft, to become a journeyman in this. This cash crop provides all the financial means. Look, I want to be up front. Baltimore City didn't give me a penny to do this project. I had to self-fund everything from ground up and out. And like Blanche DuBois, we relied upon the kindness of strangers, you know, to make this thing happen. So it's a teaching tool. And I've sort of grounded this in teaching, right? And so I'm a food educator, right? I consider myself pretty food savvy. And I was doing a cooking class with some kids. And I said, so go out to the garden and bring me some basil, some tomatoes, and some carrots, right? And they came back a little while later with basil and tomatoes, no carrots. And I said, where's the carrots? I go, Chef G, there's no carrots out there. I said, no, there's carrots out there. And they go, Chef G, we're not stupid, all right? Carrots are orange. There's nothing orange out there, all right? And then it just, that was like this sort of aha moment for me. It's like, man, if you don't know where a carrot comes from, how, you know, you don't know, right? So we went out and, you know, they're looking at carrots. We pulled them up out of the ground, and it's like, aha, right? And it was an aha moment for both of us. And it was a moment that forever changed the way I teach, right? I no longer assume. I no longer have an assumption that the things that I'm talking about are things that are on the radar screen or kids have the same reference points. So you just begin at the beginning and move forward. So that young man right there in the green T-shirt, Greg Strella, he's my farm manager. And he's really the success behind the Great Kids Farm. He's a brilliant, brilliant young man. And when I was interviewing for a farm manager for my farm, I had this room full of these farmers, and they were all talking about, you know, crop rotation, you know, and it's just like all the stuff that I had no idea. Look, the only thing I knew about sustainable farming were some dudes in Mississippi that were growing pot, right? So that was sort of, you know, that was the only cash crop that I knew about, right? But there was this one guy in the room, and he kept asking me questions about kids. Well, how does it connect to the kid? How is the kid going to be involved? How does the kid, you know, and he just kept asking me this question. And Greg Strella is a graduate of MICA. He's an artist. He's an amazing artist, painter. And I said, that's my farmer. That's my farm manager. And we together sort of Forrest Gumped our way through this thing, you know. And he's done an amazing job. He's now considered sort of a national expert. But those are like trays and trays of microgreens. that we do. And look, we get 3 cash crops a month, you know? So our turnover is quick. And we have a kid who's blind who harvests because you don't need sight. You need scissors and feel, right? So it's all about sort of figuring out connections and figuring out things that work, you know, and tearing down the box. So, and those 3 kids right there, blue shirt, striped shirt, orange shirt, but those are the 3 kids that began the catalyst of change in Baltimore City, right? They called me up and they said, the food sucks. I said, yeah, I know, I've seen it. They go, no, it sucks. And I said, well, what are you guys going to do about it? Well, we don't know. How do we change this? And so these kids took their school lunch that was served that day to the school board meeting. And they brought the trays in. They turned the trays upside down, and nothing fell off. And they said, you try it. Not one school board member was willing to eat school lunch. Right? And it became a moment that people had to get real about this thing. And they said, you're right. This isn't working. It doesn't work. And that sort of became the catalyst of change. Those 3 kids, I got to take to Washington, D.C. I'm pretty political. I'm pretty connected to the White House and to this food movement. And when they were doing testimony during the reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act, it was the first time in American history that children got to testify before Congress about a law that directly affected them. Look, man, it was like living through a Schoolhouse Rock episode, you know? Seeing these kids, and they were just like floored that they had the power to do this stuff. And a couple of these kids, like, it really, the light went off. And like, 20 years from now, look out, y'all, all right? These guys know the power, all right? So it's cool stuff. So I wanted to take this brand new approach, right? Fresh, local food. So up until this point, Baltimore City had never purchased a piece of fresh produce in their, you know, recent history. And they were purchasing, like, USDA commodity stuff, packed in cans of corn syrup that traveled 2,200 miles to get there. Right? Because that's how we've always done it. Right? So, you know, I lived on a sailboat in Baltimore. We've got a big catch. And I got off my little boat and I went online. I found this website called Maryland's Best, right? And it sort of identifies a bunch of farms in Maryland. And I went to this farm, the Boggers Farm, and I met this farmer, Les Deet, right? And he was running peaches at the time. And I said, Les, you know, how do we do this together? How do we make this thing work? And so we spent the day really in his truck driving around this farm, not really talking about business. We were talking about this farm. We'd go from field to field to field, and he would tell me what happened in this field 25 years before, 50 years before, 75 years before, 100 years before, 150 years before. And I realized this was not a piece of dirt. This was a family's legacy. This was a family's connection to this world. And their blood and their sweat and their soul was directly infused in the soil and the trees and the very fiber of this place. And it was very humbling. It was very humbling. And he talked about his farm the way I talk about cooking, you know? And I got it. I got where he was coming from. And we went back to the packing house, and so he had peaches. And I said, okay, Les, here's what we'll do. Pick every peach off the tree. I don't need stickers. I don't need boxes. Put them in a wooden field crate. And that wooden field crate, we'll put them on the back of your truck. From your truck, we'll go to my warehouse. From my warehouse, I'll go to my schools. I'll wash the fruit. I'll serve the fruit. I'll bring the empty crates back to my warehouse. You drop the next load, you backhaul the empty boxes, and we do this again until you're out of peaches and I'm out of money. And when he ran out of peaches, we went to apples and pears. And pretty soon, we had done all this stuff. Of course, I didn't get a lot of permission to do this stuff, right? And as a recovering altar boy, me Koopa, me Maxima Koopa, I just knew I'd have to do some Hail Marys, right? How many? Who knows? Who cares, right? But on the very first day of school, on my very first day on the job,
I was at Lockerman Bundy School, this little school, little hard school. And I sat with three second graders, three semi-toothed second graders, right? And I forget how small they are, and I forget how tiny they are. This one little kid is like rubbing his peach along his face. And I said, it's supposed to feel that way. And the other kid is like breathing into this peach. And I said, it's supposed to smell that way. And this third kid is like biting into the peach, and the juice is running down his face and down his arm. And he's got this big smile that's coming over his face, and it's supposed to taste that way. And this was the very first time in their lives that they had had an opportunity to taste a fresh peach. We live in the land of plenty. How is it that a kid in an urban environment doesn't get that, doesn't get to have that? This is within our power. We have to change that. So we began with peaches. That was sort of our beginning. So how do you build a farm with no money, no resources, and you know, a lot of vision, some chutzpah, right? But it takes a community. Every community is the same, you guys. Every community has doctors and lawyers and engineers and farmers and plumbers and carpenters, mechanics, and they all have children. They all have children. In every one of your communities, this exists. And we just started calling out and saying, look, everybody know the story of Stone Soup, right? So there's this village, they're starving to death, you know? And this dude rolls into town, he's got this big pot, some water in it, drops a rock in it, starts stirring the pot. Somebody comes by and says, what are you doing? Oh, I'm making stone soup. Says, no, it's a rock with some water. No, it's stone soup, it's pretty good. It's got a lot of iron in it, I think. And, you know, it'd be better if there was other stuff. And the guy says, well, I've got a potato. Well, throw it in, man. Somebody else came by and said, I got an onion. Throw it in. I got a cabbage. Throw it in. I got a chicken. Throw it in. I got a carrot. Throw it in. And pretty soon, everybody's got one little piece. And they're throwing it into the pot. And the next thing you know, this pot is this nutritionally dense stew that staves starvation off and saves this village. Stir the pot. Be a pot stirrer. Begin this process. So it also takes kids, right? So everything that I touch, do, think, and am involved in right now in my life, it has a direct connection to a kid. And if it doesn't have a direct connection to a kid, I don't do it. It's not worth doing. You know, time is precious. And so these kids, they don't look like farmers, but they are some hardcore urban farmers. And they were there on a snowstorm preparing a place for our goats that were donated. So like Great Kids Farm, the beauty of Great Kids Farm, it has a history of like throwaway, cast-offs, right? It was an abandoned orphanage. So, you know, a farmer said, I got some goats, man. You want some goats? Yeah, I'll take them, you know? And so they were building a place for them. And I wanted the goats because I wanted the kids to see this alternative way of land management and clearing, right? That the goats would, clear, fertilize, aerate, all without a coffee break or a union grievance, right? And I'm amazed by goats, right? Like, I didn't know goats could climb trees. And after I had to, pull a couple of goats out of trees, you know, I sort of realized that. And when I first brought goats to Baltimore, it was like bringing a herd of unicorn into Baltimore. On the first weekend, there were over 200 cars that showed up to this farm to see the goats, right? It's just like it blew me away, right? But that's Heckle and Jekyll. These guys were sort of my partners in crime. And, you know, I got this net down, right? And when I would come to the farm, I'd shout that out. And wherever they were at my side. And whatever I did, they did with me. And we sort of rolled around. So it was a cool experience. So So how do you do a farm? So you sort of start with this idea that it's possible. And so we started composting. We got with the city, and we got them to start saving, you know, brush, leaves, anything that we could sort of do to create our own soil. And the kids started, you know, tilling the ground. And then we started planting things. And it became this amazing farm. Look, we didn't have money to buy wheelbarrows, right? And there was this kid that came up to me. It's a true story, right? This kid comes up to me and he goes, Chef G, don't worry about no wheelbarrows. I said, okay, man. The next day I showed up, the parking lot is full of shopping carts, right? Home Depot and Office Depot shopping carts. And they became the urban wheelbarrows. And man, we used these things. I mean, we used these things for over a month. And when I knew I was going to go to jail, my wife is an attorney, risk manager, and says, you're going to go to jail. And so I took the urban wheelbarrows back to the local Home Depot, and I told him, look, don't, yeah, I got them. And, you know. And when the guy stopped laughing, he wrote me a check for $1,000 and gave me 6 wheelbarrows. And at a regional meeting of Home Depot, it sort of trickled up the ladder to a guy named Arthur M. Blank. He's the founder of Home Depot, owns the Atlanta Falcons. And he thought it was pretty bitchin'. And he asked me to come to Atlanta. And, you know, he's been a good friend and a supporter. And I do a lot of consulting work for him now. And, like he believes in innovation. And this for him was innovative. You know, that it's like you saw a need, you filled the need, you got it done. Right? You know, it wasn't, you know, Grand Theft shopping cart. It was innovation, right? So very, very, very cool stuff. And so then it evolves, right? So you start planning. Our kids are planning. We're sort of teaching them about the process. The goats keep clearing, right? They keep eating fields, overgrown fields. Then we found there was an old abandoned trailer on the back part of the land, and we built our little mobile chicken coop, right? And we would move the coop from field to field, and the chickens would scratch and aerate and fertilize and do all that stuff. Like, we didn't have money to buy actual chickens in the beginning, but we got eggs, right? We hatched our first chickens, you know, in this little room. And this was, like, that kid right there, he was an intern, right? You know, like, that's the other thing. I went to all of the colleges, and I said, I have this amazing place. Come on out, man. Come on out, and whatever works for you, however you can fit it into your curriculum or your vision, we'll find a spot for you. And, you know, bees, we started with bees, you know, because we knew that the bees would work. Penn State was a big supporter of this and helped us to get this thing launched. And then, you know, it all, here, let me go back to that. So this is kind of our little deal. That kid right there feeding those goats, he originally came out to the farm because his probation officer said he had to, right? He came out under duress. He was a thug, man. This kid was a hardcore thug. He is now a sophomore at the University of Maryland in an ag program. He's going to be a farmer. Kind of amazing stuff. This guy spent the summer there and went home and started building gardens with some of the grandparents in the neighborhood and started making it a little safer and started being reconnected with what was real. And very cool stuff. So look, I'm an artist, right? And, you know, so I think art is wonderful. And so my kids like pizza. So I said, oh, okay, well, so we'll do pizza, but, you know, we'll do it a little differently. So there were a group of some hippie kids that approached me, and they said, dude, we could be making earth ovens. And I said, okay, you know. So earth ovens are sort of this ancient technology. They exist all over the planet, right? Virtually every culture, with the exception of, like, Inuits, make bread, right? So they went down. We had this little open field day at the farm one day, And so we had straw, and the kids went down to the river and brought up mud. They laid out a tarp, and they had a drum circle, and they were dancing in the mud and the straw. And, you know, they started free-forming this earth oven. Well, they're supposed to be built on a base of, like, granite or some other sort of dense stone. Well, we don't have that in Baltimore. We have a lot of busted-up concrete. So I told the kids, our earth ovens will have a special stone. It's called urbanite, right? So we built ours out of urbanite, you know. And we put in a pizza patch next to the pizza oven where, you know, there's tomatoes and basils and peppers and eggplant and garlic, and they literally grow their own pizza and go over and cook it. And it's like, it's amazing to watch them do this stuff. And they're just like so empowered. And so there's a cute little line in the Cafeteria Man film. There's, you know, all the kids are like, they're making salsa and chopping stuff up. And there's this one kid that goes, it tastes like professional people made this. You know? So it's pretty cool. So anyhow, paying the bills. Look, there's a reality to this, all right? You've got to pay the bills. It's got to be economically solvent, you know? You've got to be able to sustain yourself. And look, I don't believe in, you know, my handout, you know, for, you know, grants and grants and grants and grants and how are you going to keep my doors open, all right? You know, I believe grants have an important role in startup capital. But that's what it is. It's startup capital, right? You take the money and you leverage it and you turn it into something else. So we had all these greenhouses that all the glass was broken, nothing worked, and we just, you know, kind of repaired, and, you know, people gave us stuff. There's an ag trader out there, and we just put an ad out and we said, look, we're a startup, 33-acre farm operated by kids, and we need your help. And farmers are pretty amazing people, right? So, you know, there'd be a guy who'd call me up and say, you know, I got this tractor. I've had it for a while. I don't use it. And, you know, I'll drop it off. And another guy's got a tiller. And another guy's got some hand tools. And another guy's got some posts. And another guy's got some fencing. And another guy, you know, and all of a sudden people are dropping stuff off. But not just dropping stuff off, because we're asking them, what grows good here? You know, how do we make this thing work? And rather than us wasting our time and wasting the precious few resources that we had to do this stuff, we relied upon the wisdom of our elders. Right? Crazy concept, man. You know, instead of reading a technical manual about how the sweet potato should look, it's like, you know, how does this work? And they would come. And they were tickled to help. They were happy to help. They were excited that there was new energy and new vitality in this industry that had sustained them, that had created a wonderful lifestyle for them, and to see this happen again and see it grow. So we do, you know, a lot of stuff. So we do, like, you know, worms. We have a vermiculture program. We sell worms. Will Allen's a buddy of mine. I don't know if anybody knows him. He's like king of the worms, right? And he's this enormous giant of a man who is a professional basketball player. And so we did a little open house out of the Great Kids Farm. And like his housewarming present, 300 pounds of worms. That's what he gave me so we could get started, so we could get this thing going, right? And, you know, it was awesome. And he showed us how to use them. And he showed it, you know, how it works. And the thing about this is like the Great Kids Farm became sort of the mothership, if you will, right? You know, it was a place where like the other, like the 200 and something schools in the district could use as a resource. Like if they wanted to start like a vermiculture program, would say, look, you know, for, you know, on the cheap, you can get a plastic tub from Walmart or wherever, throw some soil in it, start some worms at the bait shop, literally, and, you know, start feeding it your compost, and then the next thing you know, you've got, like, a system that can generate some money. So for as little as $40 and as much as, like, $1,500 for a full-on commercial operation, you can go into business, right? So mushrooms, same hippie kids, right, came to me and said, you know, Chef G, we could do mushrooms, dude. I said, I bet you could, you know? I said, no, no. the kind everybody can have. And I said, oh, okay, right? So, you know, they sort of showed me that by, you know, inoculating some fallen trees that we already had on the property with mushroom spores, that we could start, you know, a shiitake crop that, you know, then became sort of self-sustaining. And then my restaurateurs had another product that they could incorporate into their menu. So I had a market for it, I had a need for it, and I had a way to get it there, right? So it was very cool. This last Christmas, my mother-in-law gave me a shiitake log that, you know, we harvest, you know, I made a mean marsala off of it, you know, on our fireplace step. So it was kind of cool. But yeah, this is like really easy stuff to do. It's simple, you know, and it's scalable and transferable, right? So salad greens, look, a lot of my kids have never had access to good food, to nutrient-dense food. They live in food deserts. Where they get to shop is at a bodega that's more interested in selling you Kool-Aid, chips, cigars, and Dinty Moore cans of stew than they are anything else, right? So we thought, look, let's like create a network of school gardens where kids could start doing that. And as you well know, I know I'm preaching to the choir here in the room, that, you know, like a raised bed can be old pallets, right? It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be expensive, you know? It has to be innovative, you know? And we started doing this, and our schools started, you know, producing, like, real food. And then we had this idea that, so what if we took it to the next level? I had a group of kids that came out to the Great Kids Forum. I had a grant, right, for these kids that were in foster care, right? These kids grew up in miserable, miserable conditions most of their lives. And I had this grant for 50 kids to go out to the Great Kids Farm, and the idea was to create jobs, real jobs that they could do, that they could have ownership of, that they could make a living wage at. And we decided we were going to do this inner city urban farming hoop house village, right? And you know, and Tom Hanworker, a friend of mine, was here earlier today, helped me set this thing up and roll with it. And so I had a grant for like 50 kids, and people were going, man, you're just like wasting your money. Why are you? These kids won't do this. These kids are not interested in this. These kids will fail. These kids will destroy it. These kids will vandalize it. Don't waste your time. And you know, I'm the eternal optimist. Not only do I think the glass is half full, I know the waiter's coming by to fill it up, all right? So on the final day of the interviews to pick these 50 kids that were going to be part of this urban farming project, I'm walking down the hallways of Lake Clifton High School, and there were 250 kids there in borrowed shirts and ties waiting to impress me so they could get this gig. So they didn't have to live in a neighborhood that odds are they were going to get murdered before the next school year. It's a travesty that we live in a nation that is possible. You know, that we live in it. Look, we will bail out every bank, every automaker, every industry on this planet, but the kids that we're handing the bill to, we won't even feed them. This is crazy. You know, and it's something that we can change, and people should be angry about that, and people should be ready to talk about that and figure out ways to change that. So what we did, through a $5,000 grant, we built these three hoop houses, right? And we started growing stuff immediately. So Baltimore has heavy metal problems, so we laid like polymer shields down on the bottom, and then trucked in organic soil from day one with organic plugs day one, and grew food day one that now supply that school, farmers markets, and some restaurants in the area. And kids run this, and a foundation is part of this operation. And because we wrote legislation to only buy from Maryland Farms, I am mandated by law to buy from my children. Sometimes you gotta use their own magic against them, all right? You know, I learned this from Harry Potter, all right? So, So kids, you know, not only are we planning like food, we're doing flowers, like, you know, it's also about the aesthetic beauty. It's also about sort of nature. It's also about, you know, creating an environment of teaching and learning and at their pace. And it's pretty amazing to watch these guys do this stuff. You know, our kids eat as much as they harvest. But that's cool, you know, that's a hard little school in the city. This is a brilliant man. His name is Denzel. And he helped me to launch Bees, you know, all throughout the city. And it was the same thing. We heard from, you know, the naysayers, you're killing the kids! They're going to die from bee attacks! So, you know, we have EpiPens, you know. You know, kids weren't dying from the bee attacks, you know. Kids were learning how, you know, cooperative communities do cool stuff, right? And they were learning lessons that they were not learning in their schools. It was amazing to sort of watch this process happen. And it was amazing to see all of these talented people coming out of the woodwork from all over the city, from all over the state, really, to help, to bring what they had to the pot of stone soup, you know? So I wanted to green the city, right? But I didn't want to use traditional trees. I wanted to use fruit-bearing trees, right? So I got on the phone, and from a previous connection, I knew the American Fruit Growers Association. I called them, and I said, look, here's my idea. I want to start planting fruit trees in all the schools. They said, oh, that's a cool idea. Can you have somebody out at your farm on such and such a date? And I said, yeah, sure. Well, they showed up with a tractor trailer with 800 mixed variety fruit trees as a donation and said, plant them. So we did a lottery, and we had kids. You notice any adults in there? It's all kids. And they took trees, and they started planting trees in their schools. And they became the stewards of those trees. There's an old sort of proverb that my grandfather used to tell me that the farmer that plants the orchard is often not the farmer who gets to rest under the canopy of the trees, right? These guys are orchard builders. They got that. They got that they were planting an orchard not for themselves, but for their little brothers and sisters, maybe their children, you know? And they took that responsibility seriously. So it was amazing to watch these guys do it. Yeah. So, look, there's like five kind of proven strategies to get this stuff going, you know? It's just like you start with a goal, right? You know, and the goal can be simple, you know? I'm going to plant an herb garden. I'm going to get some coffee cans and put some herbs and set them on my windowsill, and that's how I'm going to start. It doesn't have to be a 33-acre farm. It can be anything. But the second sort of rule that I live by, the most important rule, I think, is start, start, start. Begin something, anything. Begin with a single step. You know, like, again, like, you know, I don't have a farming background, you know, but I know the value of it, you know. I'm certainly like a weekend away from drawing bisons on the walls when it comes to technology, but I understand the value of it, right? You know, and I embrace it. And like, if I don't get it, I'm going to find somebody else that does. It's going to help me to sort of get it done. And then partner, communicate, be resourceful, you know, be an urban wheelbarrow, you know. This was resourceful thinking. You know, and we drew upon the resources that we had available to sort of get that stuff done. And don't be afraid, right? Like, what is the worst possible thing that can happen? That you have to begin again and do something else? You know, this is life. You know, this thing, I had this near-death experience, and it forever changed the way I look at life. It forever changed the way I look at things, right? Like, I get where you're here for a nanosecond in time. A nanosecond in time. And we can waste this moment, or we can do some amazing things. if we choose to. It's a choice. So remember that everybody is inexperienced, and remember that you begin with your level of experience. And also know that, look, your plans are going to evolve, and they're going to change, because you're going to tell your plan to somebody who's going to say, that's awesome. What if we also did this? What if we also did that? And pretty soon, this plan is evolving and changing and shifting and moving, and it takes on a life of itself, and it has its own inertia of creativity. Pretty amazing stuff. I grew up in the 60s, right? There was this young president, and this young president said, in this decade, we will put a man on the moon. In this decade. I remember that speech very clearly. I was a little kid, but I remember it. We didn't have rockets that would not blow up on themselves. We didn't have guidance devices to get us from here to there. We didn't have technology to support his vision. We didn't have a lot of things to make this possible. But this young president said, in this decade, we will put a man on the moon. In that decade, a lot of wild things happened. A lot of our leaders who spoke out about injustice were murdered for what they spoke out about. A lot of our leaders were murdered because they chose to defy convention and wanted to change things and were willing to change things. In that decade, we fought wars that maybe we should not have been involved in. We fought wars with people that are now our trade partners. In that decade, a lot of social upheaval happened, and a lot of injustices were righted in that decade. In the summer of 1969 in July, in the living room of my grandfather, a man who did not speak English, a man who saw air travel happen in his lifetime, we watched men walk on the moon. It was amazing. It was powerful. And we did that because we willed that to happen. We willed it to happen. There's nothing more than that. We as a people decided that we are going to do this. We are going to go there. What we're all gathered here today to talk about and to share ideas about is this notion of accessible, sustainable food to feed our planet, to feed our children, to make this a better place. This is not rocket science. This is something we've been doing for thousands of years. This is not new. This is not innovative. This is what we know. We need to relearn the wisdom of our grandparents. We need to relearn the wisdom that has made this country great. The things that made this country great were agriculture and entrepreneurship. We set ourselves apart from the planet because of that. This is something that we can do. Not in 10 years, not in this decade, but in a few years. But we have to will this to happen. You have to make a conscious decision that this is what you want, that this is what is important. And when the naysayers come to you and say, oh, it's not possible, the bureaucracy will kill it, then kill the fucking bureaucracy. Thank you. All right. Big Pickle fan. All right. Questions? So do you guys want to do some Q&A?
I don't think we're doing Q&A.
All right.
Sorry. Because that's what I was told. Thank you so much, Tony. Thank you so much, Tony, for coming here today and sharing your insights. I know I truly gained a lot from that speech, and I was very inspired. I really hope to carry your can-do, your no excuses, no bullshit, you cuss so I can too, attitude, just do it, with me at the farm and in my future endeavors, whatever they might be. So thank you. And also, thank you to all of you for coming here to make this conference the success that it was. This has been a great experience, so clap. Also, I just want to, again, extend my thanks to my bosses, Matt and Jen, for doing all the work that they've done to organize the conference and host the conference. And while they were doing all of that, they were also still managing the college farm. So clap for them, too. All right. Now it's business time. So a couple things before you leave. First, we have some light refreshments out in the lobby. So please enjoy them and get fueled up for your long rides home or short rides home. And also, while you're down there, please recycle your name tags. There's a box for them there. And also, there's a box for your conference evaluation forms. So take the time to fill those out because your feedback is really valuable. Also, someone brought me this glasses case, and it has a little flash thingy in it. If it's yours, if your name is BB, come pick it up from right there. Finally, we are offering an optional twilight tour of the college farm if you haven't seen enough. We're going to be rendezvousing out front, outside of the lobby at the parking lot in about 20 minutes, and then shuttles will take us from here to there, or you can drive yourself, and then we'll bring the shuttles back here afterwards. So that's it. One more thing that I would like to mention is that Tony has got a new job. He's going to move to Memphis, and he's going to be the food and nutrition director of their public school system. So he's going to take all that wisdom he learned at Baltimore and take it to Memphis now. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome.
What's your normal speaking cost?
I kind of do it on a sliding scale depending on the organization.
My name's Dave Foster. I'm
here, let me give you a card. Let me sort of. Yeah, sure.
And there's such a need.
Yeah.
We have a sustainability studies major at the college with a sustainable ag track, and a city crying out in great need right next door.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah.
That'd be awesome. How soon are you heading down to Memphis?
Tomorrow morning.
Okay. Thanks again.
All right, yeah, you bet. No, no, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. So how'd we do, Sarah?
Hey, I'm inspired.
Yeah?
I want to talk more about your agro hometown.
Yeah, oh, okay, all right. Yeah, just shout out, yeah.